Welcome back for the second hour of Issues, Etc. It's Open Lines, and Open Lines will lap a bit into the third hour of the program, but that should not dissuade you from getting your calls in early and often. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. It's become customary that when the pastor ascends the pulpit, he stands there. Of course, he's going to preach God's word, but we expect a story or two, don't we? I remember a church I attended when I was in high school. I'll be honest with you, I went to the church because of a girl. I was not there for the preaching. I did a lot of other things at that church because of the girl. You know, these are the kind of things that the teenager's hormones will drive him to do. And I'm just being honest, all right? Now, this pastor was, I should say, well known in his congregation for having sermons that were one story after another. And I'm not joking. One story after another. There were very few words in the sermon that were not in some way or fashion part of a string of stories that would last about 10-15 minutes. And when the stories were all done, there would be some concluding thought that was supposed to tie them together, and then the sermon was over. Didn't seem to have any real direct relation to any Bible passages. It was simply a series of stories, thoughts, strung together in a very whimsical manner. I will admit, this pastor was a good storyteller. He could spin a yarn. He didn't even just have to spin them. He could lay them out. And it was, as far as simple listening pleasure, very easy to listen to, very engaging. It was difficult, however, to tell what was being said because it was all illustration and nothing by way of what was being illustrated. In other words, you see the president get up for his State of the Union address, and he's going to have propositional statements. He's going to say, this is what is going on in our country, and this is what I intend to do about it. And then occasionally, he will tell a story, usually with someone sitting there in the gallery in a place of prominence. He'll tell the story of so-and-so. The president did this today, didn't he? He appeared in the Detroit area where he had a group of Iraqi dissidents, and he had a few things to say, but he illustrated it by way of telling the stories of the Iraqi dissidents that he had met with and others. In other words, the illustration served the points he was making. Now, I talk about this pastor from my high school days. The point was, there was no point. There were illustrations, but no points to be illustrated. And one walked away feeling as though they had heard, some interesting stories. It certainly kept my attention. But I don't know if I learned or discovered or really heard anything of substance, except a few stories. Now, most pastors are not this way. Most pastors pepper their sermons and their messages with stories in an appropriate way. They have a point, and then they use the story to illustrate the point. Here's a question for you. When your pastor tells a story from the pulpit, especially when it's a story that is specific to a time or an event, history or a person of history, or a popular person, a well-known person, do you expect that story to be 100% true? Or would you allow your pastor the latitude of repeating the occasional urban legend from the pulpit? Or the occasional stock boilerplate illustration from a book of illustrations that were simply made up by somebody or passed from hand to hand until no one knows whether the story, the illustration, is true. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I tell very few stories in my preaching. Lots of propositional statements. You know, I'm a young guy. I don't have a lot of stories to tell. And I'll be honest with you, I don't own the books that have the stories in them, and even if I did, I'd have a hard time bringing myself to use them. I'd be afraid that the last preacher, last week, used the same story. I'm afraid it would tarnish my credibility. Do you like stories in preaching? Does it make a difference if the stories themselves are true? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. What is it about an illustration that you remember? The illustration or the thing that was being illustrated? And does it make a difference? You walk away and you'll remember that story the rest of your life. But if someone says, but what was the point of the sermon? Oh, I don't know. I've completely forgotten the point of the sermon. But I'll remember that story the rest of my life. Little Billy and his tugboat, or, you know, the boy, the grandpa and the kid sitting on the fishing, on the bank fishing. I'll remember that story the rest of my life. What was the story? What was the sermon about? I don't know. I don't know. It was a great story, though. The phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Would you give your pastor latitude in repeating, by way of illustration, an urban legend? If a story that he uses as an illustration turns out to be untrue, should he at least acknowledge that he was telling a story that was not true? I have laying here in front of me someplace. Where did it go? Ah, lift the folder. There it is. From a church that's looking for a pastor. There are a lot of churches out there looking for pastors. And a few criteria to look for in a pastor on this list. This just came across my desk. Now, what I'm curious with regard to this is, what would you put as your first criterion for a pastor? What's most important for you when you're looking for a pastor? This list, in no particular order as far as I can tell, begins with a strong leader and administrator who is decisive and a good organizer. That's not a bad quality to have. Although I have discovered through hard experience that the term decisive and strong leader sometimes have drawbacks. In other words, pastor gets his way no matter what. A conservative who is supportive of his church body? Is that one of the highest priorities for you when you're looking for a pastor? What about a good counselor or a listener or a friendly individual who shows interest in all segments of the congregation? Someone who's able to deliver an inspiring sermon that can be understood by all segments of the congregation and applied to our daily lives? This is pretty standard stuff. What are you looking for in a pastor? What's the first and foremost priority there for you? Strong in evangelism, outreach, and new member assimilation? An enthusiastic individual who can get members excited about doing God's work? Or, here's one, teaches the entire Bible, law and gospel in its truth and purity? Which of these are most important to you in your pastor, and why? Or is there something missing from this list? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. First up during open lines, Mark calling from his car. Mark, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Pastor Todd, since you're talking about using stories, I was wondering if David and Nathan doesn't maybe give sanction to the use of a story to make a theological point or to make a point to an individual.
Well, okay, then let's explore that a bit if we could, Mark. The story that Nathan tells, the prophet Nathan tells David, and I'm assuming you're talking about the David and Bathsheba incident.
Absolutely.
The story that he tells is the story of a rich man who had great flocks, and yet he took the single lamb from a poor man in order to feed a visiting dignitary. And this enrages David, of course. What was the story intended to illustrate?
Well, I think what it was intended to do was to sidestep David's defenses so that, you know, the point could be made that this is what he had done in taking Bathsheba from her husband and then killing her husband.
Very good, Mark. Very good. All right. So, in other words, it was intended to illustrate what David had done.
Correct.
The sin that David had committed.
Right.
When was the last time you heard a story in a sermon intended to do that very thing, illustrate the sin that you had committed?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure that I've ever heard that. I think the use is a little bit different. But I guess it seems to me that, you know, there is a proper use for these things to, as I said, sidestep defenses and to bring things home. You know, is to kind of make, again, it's like if you're talking to people, I've found if I tell people that I'm a sinner, you know, that's different from me trying to tell them that they're a sinner. And again, if I tell them that I'm a sinner, then they can apply that to themselves. That's that same truth. And I think, you know, it's kind of what use you're making of the story. or how it's being used.
Mark, thank you very much. Mark makes a good point, and that is, and he's making the point in answer to a question, what should a story do? A story should have some function. I told the story at the beginning of the hour here about the preacher I used to listen to in high school, not of my own church, but a church I used to visit because of a girl who had one story after another, but there was no point. It was simply a string of stories. They may have had a common theme, but the theme was apparent really only to the preacher, as far as I could tell. Maybe I just wasn't that good of a listener. But there didn't seem to be a point of which the stories were illustrative. But Mark makes a great point. Here's an example from Scripture. Nathan the prophet, he comes and he preaches to David. He uses a story, as Mark says, to sidestep David's defenses and to make a point, David, this is you. You are the man. This is the sin you have committed. So there is a proper place for the telling of stories, even if they're fictional. This one was fictional. Nathan was simply telling a parable. Yet at the same time, the story was quite true, wasn't it? Because it was really about David. But it wasn't about a lamb, and it wasn't about a rich man. It was about a king and another man's wife. But the story had a point outside the story. When was the last time you heard an illustration in a sermon that had the point, that drove home the point like that? The sin you have committed. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I mean, all of us want to, when we sit down on Sunday morning to hear the sermon, all of us want the sermon to go well. My general experience has been, as one who has been in the pulpit and in the pew, that most everybody's there rooting for the pastor to get through the thing and to pull it off with some measure of success. In other words, to clearly communicate God's word. We want the pastor to preach the word to us. There is a natural inborn, that is inborn by the Holy Spirit, not by our fallen nature, an inborn thirst in Christians to hear the word of God preached purely. It's also counterbalanced by our fallen nature that has itching ears that desires to hear only what it wants to hear. But according to the new man, we want to hear the word. We say, Pastor, preach it. Give me the law and give me the gospel, both in their sternness and their sweetness. So in that pursuit, it's occasionally nice to hear a good story, but does the story need to have some function? Do you like it when your pastor tells stories? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Recently on Channel 5, there was this is KSDK here in St. Louis, there was a feature on miracles. Did you happen to see this? I saw the promos for this thing in advance for a couple weeks. I wondered what it might be, but of course it didn't spark enough interest in me to actually watch the thing. From the website of News Channel 5, under the headline, Bridget's Miracle, do miracles really happen? It's a question religious leaders and scholars have studied since the beginning of time. We did some research of our own, they say, and what we found is that miracles are not just stories from long ago, they happen every day. It goes on to recount several miracles. Did you see the miracle show on Channel 5? This is a two-edged sword, if you ask me. To affirm that miracles do happen, well, Christians are pretty much bound to affirm that the miraculous is real. But there seems to be an attendant danger here as well. Because after all, miracles don't just happen, do they? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. According to George Barna, our view of our quality of life has to do with two things mostly. One is faith. The other is, you guessed it, money. Those two things are most influential in Americans' view of the quality of life. Faith and money. But sad to say, mostly money. Mostly money. This is according to the research from the Barna Research Group in Ventura, California. Their press release reads, Iraq, SARS, terrorism, a faltering economy, national image problems, moral decline. Americans have plenty on their minds these days. However, a large majority of Americans feel generally comfortable with the quality of their life at the moment, according to new research from the Barna Research Group. Two out of three adults, that's 66%, strongly affirm that they are very happy with their current life, while another one out of four, that's 22%, agreed somewhat with the notion. A total of nearly 9 out of 10 adults, 88%, claim that they are happy with their life as it is. Most people feel that their life is under control. And of those who are religious, two-thirds of all adults believe that religion is losing its influence in society. And an even higher proportion of adults, 70%, argue that they are effectively bucking the trend and that their religious faith is constantly growing deeper. People don't seem too worried about stress, although they all say that their life is growing more stressful year by year. There are two areas, according to this research, which show a strong relationship to attitudes such as these, that we're pretty happy with our lives. People's religious and socioeconomic standing. Religious faith shows a significant correlation with the life perspective. Evangelicals, for instance, are substantially more likely than any other faith segment to strongly assert that they are very happy with life, 84%. They feel connected with other people, 85%. Their religious faith is constantly growing deeper, 89%. Well, these people can't lose. And they were least likely to feel that their life is getting more stressful each year, only 14% did. The faith group most dissimilar to evangelicals was that of atheists and agnostics, pretty much a reverse of the trends among evangelicals. But an equally powerful influence as faith was money, a person's socioeconomic status. Upon comparing those who have completed college and have a household income of $60,000 or more, a group labeled by Barna as upscale, with those who did not earn a college degree and whose household earnings were less than $30,000, labeled downscale, significant differences were recorded for 6 of the 8 measures studied. Upscale adults were more likely to strongly agree that they were very happy with their life, to feel that they were connected to others, both of those are 78%, by the way, and to say that they managed the information and knowledge effectively, 75%. They were less likely to strongly agree that their faith is constantly growing deeper and that life had become too complex and that life was becoming more stressful each year. Well, after all, with $60,000 a year in your pocket, you can buy your way out of a lot of stress. I wonder which of these is more influential. And if you're a Christian who makes more than $60,000 a year, you should be pretty darn happy because you got both things going for you. Money, and at least ostensibly, faith. You know, I read this research and I asked myself, Wilkin, are you happy with your life? Would you be one of those who would say, among the 84%, you're very happy with your life as it is? And I thought and thought about this, and the only thing I could do was constantly come back to this question, and that is, what do you mean by happy? I mean, I know how I feel about my life on a day-to-day basis. It seesaws like everybody else. I'm generally satisfied. Would I change things? Certainly I would, but if it stayed this way, I wouldn't be disappointed. I'm generally happy, but I would probably use the word satisfied. See, that term happy is a difficult one for me because there are things about my life that I don't like. But I wouldn't change them. You see what I mean? They don't make me happy, but I still wouldn't change them. What about you? 505-7850-1-800-730-2727. Bob, thanks for being patient. He's calling from Florissant. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Pastor Todd. I'm calling in reference to the subject of the illustrations and sermons.
Yeah.
I don't know about a whole lot of other churches. I'm a regular listener to KFUO, to your program, actually. My wife and I go to a church, we're members of a church where what is typical is a sermon that lasts approximately about an hour. We teach verse by verse through the scriptures, and the illustrations that our pastor uses are usually illustrations from his own life as God has worked things out through him before he delivers the word to us. And he just brings it verse by verse with application to us. We don't get cute little sermons on how to make your marriage better or anything like that. It's just teaching of the word of God with application for today.
Now, when you say verse by verse,
I mean if we go straight through one book of the Bible at a time.
All right, so it's kind of your classical, neoclassical expository preaching.
Yes.
It is chapter and verse, verse by verse. You start at Matthew 1:1, you go all the way to 28,
exactly.
Last verse, right?
Exactly. There might be a couple times where we might deviate from that, but not very often.
Let me ask you, because we were taught in the seminary not to use personal references in the sermon. I tossed that advice out about week 3 in the parish. Okay. Because I couldn't tell stories from somebody else's life, because I don't live somebody else's life. I'm living my own, all right? I did have illustrations there. But, you know, it's a touchy thing. When your pastor uses illustrations from his own life, or, as you said, he kind of applies the word first to himself and then shows how and hands that on to you, are they positive? You know, I've heard pastors who do this.
Yes and no.
Are they positive or negative? Or, in other words, do they reflect always positively on the pastor or negatively on him?
No.
Or is there a mixture of both?
Excuse me. There is a mixture. First of all, he stays away from the illustration booklets, which I am very glad of. I find those nauseating. If God is dealing with him in rebuking him, he's honest about that, and he'll tell us, I was having a real difficult time. I didn't want to preach this, but because, you know, he knew he was guilty of something, you know. And sometimes the illustrations are how God corrected him. Sometimes they're of how God taught him. He does not use illustrations concerning people in the congregation. He does not do that. It's personal illustrations from his own life as God works in his life.
And I guess the question that I've put there on the table is real important to ask at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Is it necessary in your mind, as one who hears that preaching on a regular basis, and you obviously are benefited by it as he expounds upon God's word? It sounds like he's preaching both law and gospel this way. Is it necessary in your mind that the stories your pastor tells, even personal illustrations, be true?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Because I think that reflects on integrity in the ministry. And if you don't have some true illustrations, if you're trying to make up how God worked in your life, people are going to know that.
Bob, I got to let you go because we're right up here on a break. I thank you very much. Now, Bob has another example here of how the illustration, a different form of illustration. Do you expect your pastor to be telling stories from the pulpit? And if so, should those stories be true? Bob said he finds the canned illustrations nauseating. What about you? We'll be right back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Is the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ historically reliable? And what can we learn about this miraculous event from extra-biblical sources? You'll find answers to these questions with the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for April, the very first Easter. The book is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this book on our website, issuesetc.org, and click the What's New section, issuesetc.org. The very first Easter is written by Dr. Paul Meyer, professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University. It's a great Easter gift for your children or your grandchildren. The book costs $12.99 plus shipping and handling. The very first Easter, our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for April. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Terry Phillips. Let the Senate vote on Miguel Estrada. That's the cry of Hispanics across the country, rallying in support of Estrada's nomination to the D.C. Appeals Court. Democrats are stonewalling that vote through a Senate filibuster. Stuart Shepard was at a rally in Florida yesterday.
Justicia para Estrada! Justicia para Estrada!
Under the burning Miami sun on the steps of the Dade County Courthouse, these people hope to change the minds of Democratic senators, and they're not all Republicans.
The liberal extremists in the U.S. Senate who are blocking his confirmation are doing this country a great disservice.
Eladio Jose Armesto is chairman of the Democratic League of Miami-Dade County.
We're here to demand the right of the American people to have this filibuster against Miguel Estrada and against pro-family Hispanics in this country to be ended.
We are here today in solidarity. We, the many, represent the hearts and the souls of countless others, others that are crying out for justice. End the filibuster. End the filibuster. End the filibuster.
Jerry Van Dalen is a minister who came to the rally.
I just want to confirm. I'd like to see him maybe one day even be the first Hispanic in the Supreme Court.
Yuri Mantilla is focused on the family's Council for Hispanic Affairs.
We strongly believe that President Bush has the right and authority according to the Constitution to appoint judges, and now they are taking away from him this right.
He says they're not asking Democrats to vote for Estrada, just to allow that vote to happen. For Family News in Focus, I'm Stuart Shepard in Miami.
Rallies were also held in Baton Rouge, Little Rock, and Albuquerque. They're an effort by Enfoque a la Familia, focus on the family's ministry to the Hispanic community. For Family News in Focus, I'm Terry Phillips.
Have you ever thought, I wish my friend in California would have heard that interview? Or, it would be great if my son in the military could regularly hear a worship service. Guess what? They can hear KFUO programs and worship services anywhere in the world by visiting our website at www.kfuo.org. Tell your friends and family worldwide to listen in to KFUO. That's www.kfuo.org.
Is the death and resurrection of Christ historically reliable? Find out with the new children's book, The Very First Easter, published by Concordia Publishing House. 1-800-325-3040. The Very First Easter is the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April. 1-800-325-3040. You can find out more about this book on the internet, issuesetc.org, and click What's New? The Very First Easter by Dr. Paul Meyer, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April.
In the next hour of Issues Etc., Douglas Johnson, Legislative Director of National Right to Life, joins us from Washington, D.C., an update on two issues. First of all, the Unborn Victims of Violence Act. This ties in, of course, with the Lacey Peterson story, and a ban on partial birth abortion. We will find out about both those things with Doug Johnson coming up in this third hour of Issues Etc. Then we'll conclude today's conversation talking with Dr. Bill Weinrich, Academic Dean and Professor of History at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. We'll talk about why the church, East and West, date Easter differently. I mean, figuring out the date for Easter in the Western Church is hard enough. First Sunday after the first full moon after the vernal equinox. You run your dictionary to try and figure out what the vernal equinox is, and then you start counting days, and you can pretty soon figure out why Easter's jumping around on the calendar as it does. And then the Eastern Church has a different Easter altogether. We'll talk about that in the last part of Issues Etc. It's open lines, Issues Etc. The phone numbers, anything you'd like to talk about, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We're talking about stories from the pulpit. Now, there's a pastor of my casual acquaintance some time back who was renowned in his congregation for telling one story very often. Same story very often. It was a story of himself. The problem is he came out looking great in this story every time. It was one of those kind of personal reference illustrations that he would use where he came out kind of as the hero. And if that weren't bad enough, the facts in the story seem to change on a regular basis. Now, I'm not going to be specific about what the story is or who this was, but the facts in the story would shift from time to time. And, you know, after people have heard the story 3-4 times in the course of the year, they start to know it and they start to notice when the details change. And, of course, that would raise the question in anyone's mind, what's the true story? Even if the details are minor, someone's going to say, well, which is the true story and is this story entirely true? And that is entirely aside from the fact that in the story, the pastor comes out looking like a hero. Do you like it when your pastor tells stories from the pulpit? Do you require at least, how many stories does he need to tell in the course of a 20-minute sermon for it to be well-rounded? Does he have to have at least one in there? Is it the same if he leaves one out? What if it's 3 stories or 4? Or as I said in the first part of the program, nothing but stories. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. A few updates for you as we're simply conversing here. This is something, I don't think I've talked about this, so this would qualify as an update, but it's something that's definitely made the news. There was a story in the Weekly Standard by Jay Bottom, Tom Daschle's duty to be morally coherent, that the headline does not do justice to the article. The story is about one Tom Daschle, who, at least according to his home diocese in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, Tom Daschle, of course, being a senator from South Dakota, according to a letter sent to him from his home diocese in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, may no longer call himself a Roman Catholic in public references. The bishop of his home diocese is asking the senator to no longer refer to himself as a Catholic. According to the American Life League, this is their news release on it, according to the Weekly Standard, and later echoed on MSNBC's Joe Scarborough show, Senator Tom Daschle, a member of the American Life League's Deadly Dozen, that is 12 pro-abortion Catholic senators, he's one among the dozen, has been sent a letter from his home diocese of Sioux Falls informing him he can no longer publicly identify himself as a member of the Catholic Church because of his unrepentant support of abortion and other pro-death legislation. Quote, the recent actions involving Daschle are totally in agreement with the teachings of the Catholic Church and make crystal clear the point of our Deadly Dozen ad. That's got to be a typo. The recent actions involving Daschle are totally in agreement with the teachings of the Catholic Church and make crystal clear our point about the Deadly Dozen ad. You cannot be a Catholic and pro-abortion, said Judy Brown, president of American Life League. The Weekly Standard article was occasioned by a letter from the Bishop of Sioux Falls, His Excellency Robert Carlson, that he sent to Senator Daschle, in which he refused to discuss what was supposed to be a private matter between the two men. Bishop Carlson has made clear that a grave concern must be handled privately, that is, the concern over Daschle identifying himself as a Roman Catholic, must be handled privately and should not be open to scrutiny in the public. However, it did appear in the Weekly Standard last week. Not the letter itself, but at least the concern. We respect Bishop Carlson and his attempt to deal privately with the senator. It would truly add insult to injury if anyone in Senator Daschle's office had anything to do with releasing private information to the media. So apparently the story sent to Senator Daschle from the Archdiocese was a private letter, but somehow made it to the Weekly Standard. I have the actual article from the Weekly Standard from Jay Bottom. He's books and arts editor. It reads as follows. Daschle, Tom Daschle, may no longer call himself a Catholic. The Senate Minority Leader and the highest-ranking Democrat in Washington has been sent a letter by his home diocese in Sioux Falls, sources in South Dakota have told the Weekly Standard, directing him to remove from his congressional biography and campaign documents all references to his standing as a member of the Catholic Church. This isn't exactly excommunication, which is unnecessary in any case since Daschle made himself ineligible for communion 20 years ago with his divorce and remarriage to a Washington lobbyist. The directive from the Sioux Falls Bishop Robert Carlson is rather something less than excommunication and at the same time something more, namely a declaration that Tom Daschle's religious identification constitutes, in technical Catholic vocabulary, a grave public scandal. He was brought up as a Catholic. He still may be in some sort of genuine mental and spiritual relationship to the church, who besides his confessor could say, but Daschle's consistent political opposition to Catholic teaching on moral issues, abortion in particular, has made him such a problem for ordinary churchgoers that the church must deny him the use of the word Catholic. Much of the discussion about Daschle's standing has gone on in private over the last few years, although Bishop Carlson and Senator Daschle had a very public spat about partial birth abortion back in 1997. During the run-up to a Senate vote on the issue, Daschle proposed what he called a compromise, banning the procedure while allowing exemptions for any woman who claimed mental or physical health reasons for having a late-term procedure. Pointing out the way the exemption gutted the ban, Carlson, the bishop, called Daschle's proposed compromise a smokescreen designed solely to, quote, provide cover for pro-abortion senators and President Clinton, who wanted to avoid a veto confrontation. Daschle, in turn, rose to the floor of the Senate in Washington to denounce his own bishop back in South Dakota for speaking in a way, quote, more identified with the radical right than with thoughtful religious leadership. Carlson later told the Sioux Falls Argus Leader, the newspaper, that he remained mystified by Daschle's position on abortion. Quote, NARAL claims him as one of their number one supporters. I don't understand how he can be in touch with South Dakotans as much as he is and yet consistently have a pro-abortion record. Well, it's very simple, Bishop. He wants to remain in leadership. That's as simple as it is. This year, on January 16th, Bishop Carlson received additional ammunition for his discussion with Daschle when Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger's office, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, issued in Rome a doctrinal note on Catholics in political life. Quote, a well-informed Christian conscience, the note declared, does not permit one to vote for a political program or an individual law which contradicts the fundamental contents of faith and morals. The doctrinal note marks at least the beginning of the end for the Vatican's toleration of what the Pope's biographer George Weigel has called Cuomoism in the American church. I think it's a reference to a former governor of New York, if I'm not mistaken, Mario Cuomo, another pro-choice Catholic. Cuomoism, according to George Weigel, is the effort to finesse abortion by declaring oneself personally opposed but politically supportive of laws allowing abortion. Catholics have the right and the duty to be morally coherent, the doctrinal note declares, and the Catholic fight on the life issues, abortion, euthanasia, and cloning, is not something of a merely prudential question to be decided by political give and take. The Catholic Church doesn't take political positions except when politics intrudes into something like the right to life that ought to be beyond the power of politicians. Now, the story goes on to very briefly bring a conclusion to the whole story about Daschle and whether or not he can call himself a Catholic anymore. The last two paragraphs read, there's quite a list of pro-abortion Catholics in Washington, beginning, I didn't know this, with Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic minority leader in the House, who could use similar instruction in the duty to be morally coherent. Just in the Senate, there is Joe Biden, Tom Daschle, Senator Dodd, Senator Harkin, Senator Kennedy, Senator Kerry, Senator Landrieu, Senator Leahy, Mikulski, Murray, Reid, and more pro-choice Catholics. But at least Tom Daschle's has now been forced by his bishop to assume some responsibility for moral coherence, even if it is, unfortunately, a coherence achieved in the wrong direction. In other words, you can either call yourself pro-choice or call yourself a Catholic. Make your choice, Senator Daschle. Senator Daschle chooses pro-choice. The diocese in Sioux Falls would not say what brought the issue to Tom Daschle's Catholicism to a head at this particular moment, although one South Dakotan suggested that it may have to do with Daschle's crossing of yet another line recently when he began direct funding for NARAL. Senator Daschle's office has not yet responded to a request for a comment. Bottom concludes by saying, it's a serious thing when a bishop breaks a pastoral relation, no matter how tenuous that relation may have become. But Bishop Carlson is right that the time has come to banish Cuomoism from American politics. This isn't a matter of favoring Republicans or Democrats. Regardless of their party, public figures who aren't going to oppose abortion shouldn't call themselves Catholics anymore. What do you think about this? Do you agree? The home diocese for Senator Tom Daschle says, if you're a Catholic, Tom Daschle, then you can't be pro-choice. And if you're going to continue to be pro-choice, please don't call yourself a Catholic. A good move? Would you expect the bishops in the various dioceses of all the other pro-choice House members and senators to do the same? They would have the full force and faith and credit of the Vatican behind them, because that doctrinal note makes it pretty clear. But there is silence, except from South Dakota. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Other Catholic news that's kind of been piling up here a bit. The headline, you may have seen this in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, divorced Catholics who remarry can't take communion, says the Pope. The encyclical recently delivered, and this was, if I'm not mistaken, the encyclical for Maundy Thursday, also warns against taking communion in other churches. They're holding their line on what they call close communion. In other words, Catholics commune at Catholic altars and elsewhere do not. I get the sense with the flurry of activity here that the Pope is getting as much out as he can before it's too late. There's also this headline, Catholic schools work to reinforce identity. A local teacher is honored in her efforts at a meeting of the National Catholic Education Association. The story goes on to talk about how Catholics are not being apologetic about being who they are, Catholics. The Pope is not apologizing for being the Pope. He's not apologizing for saying, if you are divorced and remarried, you can't take communion. Don't take communion at a non-Roman Catholic altar. They're holding the line. While the rest of the church seems bent upon compromise, who's bucking the trend? The good old Roman Catholics, and good for them. Oh, by the way, Archbishop Sheen is up for sainthood. The only thing he's lacking, apparently, according to the LA Times, is a miracle. You remember Bishop Sheen? He was a pioneer in Christian television broadcasting in the 50s. Well, his admirers and those who remember him fondly are seeking testimonials that could prove a miracle and put him one step closer to being a saint in the Roman Catholic Church. They have not yet found one, but that doesn't mean that it won't work out. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Miles is calling from his car. Miles, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi. I hope this is a trend. It sounds good, but the thought just struck me that a lot of these guys may simply scoff at this and go ahead and say they're Catholics anyway. That's all.
All right. Thank you very much, Miles. I don't know. This is a touchy one, because if Daschle says, "Fooey on you, Bishop, I'm going to call myself a Catholic in my campaign materials, on my website, in the stuff that I send out, I'm going to continue to call myself a devout Catholic." That could cut the other way. In other words, it could come across looking as disingenuous as it really is, especially with pro-life South Dakotans. He could also be getting himself deeper with his bishop. You remember, his bishop, in spite of the fact that he's a U.S. senator, does potentially have the authority to excommunicate him, in which case he really couldn't call himself a Catholic. I don't know if he wants to push it. What do the rest of you think? If there is, and the one website has its dirty dozen, 12 and more House members and senators who are both Roman Catholic and pro-choice. Daschle's just the latest to be told, look, you can't call yourself a Roman Catholic. His own bishop says this. Do you think they ought to be honest one way or the other? If you're pro-choice, don't call yourself a Catholic. If you're going to call yourself a Catholic, don't call yourself and don't be pro-choice. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. 2727. I was perusing the web and I came across a story in the Chicago Tribune. It was titled Interfaith Report, which caught my eye. I'm always interested in things interfaith, especially after September 11th. You never know what's going to happen. It was subtitled Respecting Other Faiths' Symbols. This is how the story goes. Interfaith worship services mark times of national grief as well as moments of national joy. Clerics and lay leaders of diverse faith meet regularly. Houses of worship are open to all. Christians attend Jewish services and vice versa, each group seeking to learn more about the other. Muslims invite members of other faiths to an iftar meal during the holy month of Ramadan. Years ago, the primary objective of interfaith exploration was to identify things shared in common so as to homogenize religious diversity into a theologically neutral, trans-denominational expression sociologist Robert Bella called American Civil Religion. It worked well, by the way, folks. Worked beautifully. It's given us what we've had post-September 11th. But you know, it's more subtle now, if I can pause from the story for a moment. Now the differences are recognized, they're just considered trivial. Today the goal is learning and respecting one another's differences. An article appearing in this space on Easter Sunday reported that many Christians are participating in Passover Seders, being held this year in 250 Chicago area churches. Those present say it's an amazing ritual filled with references to Jesus, and they credit the Seder not only with deepening their understanding of his teachings, but also heightening their appreciation of the Jewish community. At first glance, this appears to be a splendid example of interfaith sharing, as might be expected in a city, that is Chicago, that justifiably prides itself in strong ties that unite its faith communities. But look again. There are no Jews at these Seders. The participants are Christian fundamentalists. This is a story from the Chicago Tribune, whose purpose in holding them is not to enhance their understanding of Judaism. Rather, they seek to co-opt an ancient ritual still practiced by millions of Jews around the world by reinterpreting its symbols into something that is no longer Jewish but Christian. Now, this is precisely the rationale for doing the Seder among Christians, isn't it? We're going to take the ancient ritual. Let's remember, the Passover and the Seder are two completely different things. Passover is Exodus 12. Seder is the ritual that is practiced by Jews since the Passover can no longer be practiced. No more sacrifice. No more temple. Ergo, all they have left is a Seder. Christians practice the Seder. I mean, I think if they want to be completely consistent, they should practice the Passover, if they want to really immerse themselves in the history behind these things. But somehow shedding the lamb's blood just doesn't, you know, yuck. It has the yuck factor attached to it. Where's the shank bone? Maybe some minor yuck for the kids, but they can live through it. Apparently, the Jews feel like that the Christians who are doing this and reinterpreting their ancient ritual are co-opting their symbols. They say that the heightened appreciation of Judaism that comes from Christians practicing a Seder stems from a distortion of the Seder rather than a practice of the Seder. They appreciate not Jews not for the fact that they are Jews, but for this caricature identity as proto-Christians, say Jewish people. This is highly offensive to Jews, according to the story. To be sure, investing religious symbols and rituals with new meaning is as old as religion itself. Sometimes the process fosters internal changes through which a religion grows and matures. But there is evidence in the biblical text that a feast of unleavened bread, an essential secular agricultural observance, was what led to the Passover. Now, this is the take of the Chicago Tribune. But apparently, when Christians practice the Seder as a Christian event rather than simply as a Jewish event, this worries Jews. I wonder about you. Let's say the Mormons decided to take, well, they do. They reinterpret a Christian ritual, don't they? Baptism, the Lord's Supper, water and wonder bread, and they say it's something entirely different than what Christ says it was. And we are rightly we rightly oppose such a thing. To take a Christian ritual and say it's something that it isn't. Let's say, for instance, that some progressive Muslim someplace said, look, I really like the Christian practice of, say, the Lord's Supper. But since I'm a Muslim, it obviously can't have that same meaning for me. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take it as it is, words and all, but reinterpret it in such a way so that it applies to, say, Muhammad or another great prophet. And you would say, a distortion, eh? Now, don't get me wrong. It is true that Christ is the Passover. He is the fulfillment of the Passover, without a doubt. What I'm trying to alert you to, if you care, is how Jews might be seeing this. I mean, if we care about Jewish evangelism, right? And not unnecessarily offending people whom we at least claim to at some time in the future get around to preaching the gospel to. The phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Matt is calling from his car. Matt, we are short on time. We're coming up against a break here.
Okay, I'll just ask my question then. I was going to ask, is the Lord's Supper, and I guess connected with that, the crucifixion, is that, would we call that the fulfillment of the Passover, or I was going to let you answer that.
All right, thank you very much, Matt. That's an excellent question, and the answer to that is simply put, yes. The crucifixion of Christ is the fulfillment of the Passover, which is why the Passover is no longer necessary. Now, if you want to keep it around as a historical footnote or an oddity, fine and good. There's nothing wrong with that. But don't call the Seder the Passover, because the Passover required the shedding of blood. That's essential to the Passover. Blood gets shed every year until it was impossible to do so because the temple no longer existed. When Jesus and his disciples went to the upper room, downstairs in the lower room, on the threshold of the door, was real blood from a real lamb that they had taken to the temple and had sacrificed earlier that day. They celebrated the Passover. Now, the Seder might have gone along with it. We don't know how much of the Seder went along with it. But the point I'm making here, and see, Christ fulfills the Passover, making the Passover no longer necessary. Christ is our Passover, says Paul. But the point I'm making from the Chicago Tribune story is, if we're going to take an ancient ritual called the Seder from Judaism and say, well, now this is really about Jesus, you do understand how the Jews are going to look at this. They may not necessarily be happy about it. More open lines when we come back. Stay with us.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.